Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine a light on the path ahead of us, where evolution is leading. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio cast is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems together rather than defend positions. I know I've shared this story before, but it's pertinent to our current political situation and our show today. Right before the 2016 election, the Sunday before, the 60 Minutes TV show had 25 prospective voters from across the political spectrum and asked them the question, how many of you are voting for the candidate of your choice in this election? Three of them raised their hand. The question next was, how many of you are voting against another candidate? And 22 raised their hand. As we look at the tremendous frustration people have with our current system, having to choose between two less than gratifying choices, the question is, how did we get into this fix, and how do we fix the fix that we're in? Our guest today is Eric Fogg. He's the co-author of Wedged, How You Became a Tool for the Partisan Political Establishment, and How to Start Thinking for Yourself Again. Eric Fogg is a graduate of MIT, where he studied mechanical engineering and political science. He earned his Master's of Science, co-authoring a number of academic papers. While a student and while working with MIT, Harvard, and the United Nations, and other NGOs on conflict resolution. He then spent 4 years as an operations and management consultant, improving organizational effectiveness and culture for a number of clients across North America. He currently lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he is the CEO of Mid-Tide Media and co-founder of Something to Consider, focused on improving American political dialogue by undermining the destructive mindsets that ail politics in the United States. I'm going to give you a little quote from the introduction to his book. Quote, a wedge has been driven into American politics by powerful political, social, and economic incentives that are very difficult to overcome. The middle ground has fallen out of the political process, leaving power in the hands of hardline partisans that frame the national agenda and direct our political energy toward emotionally satisfying but politically unproductive tribal warfare. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show. Just listening to that quote, it's like, oh boy, here's Eric Fogg, bearer of good news.
Well, you know, I think that there is good news, because part of the good news is that we're having a look at the bad news. So speaking of that, how did, I would say in my jokey way, that the political industrial complex has given the body politic a wedgie. So how did this come about? How did our political dialogue devolve?
Yeah, great question. I think a lot of people look to 2016 as a pivotal moment where everything broke down sort of at once. And what we found actually in 2014, before, you know, Trump was on the radar, Clinton obviously was that this has been an ongoing process since the early 1990s, and 2016 is merely a symptom rather than a cause of the breakdown. And in short, the big things that changed were how we consume media and how politicians use resources to try to collect voters.
How does this work? You know, you're pointing to the 1990s. Was there a pivotal moment that shifted the trend?
Yeah, the two big changes we saw that caused a breakdown in the body politic were, one, the rise of cable news media gave people the opportunity to segment the market much more and make money by appealing to what people already thought or wanted to hear, as opposed to neutrality. And then politicians in the 80s, but with more sophistication into the 90s, started using consultants that were very, very data-driven to help them gather voters. And what those consultants found was that when you make people angry and afraid, they are much more likely to come out and vote for you than if you just talk about positions. And so what happened then was that the incentives changed for politicians running for office, because now if you didn't make people angry and afraid, you would lose to the person who did.
Hmm. And we've seen that. We've seen that time and time again. I mean, we have a totally adrenalized body politic projecting all kinds of stuff on the other side, and the chasm seems more like less like disagreement and more like alternative realities. So say more about how this has led to the perfect storm that was 2016.
What's the most interesting thing about this change is that most people will assume that the left and the right, most Americans, now deeply disagree over the core issues that are important to them, and that's the change that's occurred. But we actually found in our study in 2014 that this is not the case. Americans actually largely agree on the core issues that they seem to be fighting over. And instead, what has occurred is that because cable news TV, now, of course, the internet, similarly, and politicians running for office are so energized by the angry people that they have indeed made angry, those angry people's voices are highly amplified. So what happened was nobody wants to watch a show with, you know, a cable news show with people talking reasonably about reasonable things. So what happens is these angry partisans on the edge of the spectrum, they're the ones that get put in front of us on TV, and they're the ones who therefore command the national dialogue. So what happens is the rest of us, here's where the wedgie occurs. The rest of us are fooled into thinking through this repeated exposure that that is the national dialogue, that must be what people think, and that there isn't a middle ground. So now we have to take sides, and that's how we become tools.
Before we get into a little bit more about how we unwrap this and get ourselves out of this fix, how did you become involved and interested in this particular issue, and how did the book come about?
Great question. So I grew up in a very red part of Pennsylvania, very rural, and I moved to Cambridge to go to school. And I found that the folks I knew in the red part of Pennsylvania absolutely hated the folks that lived in Cambridge and vice versa, and they'd never met each other. And they had these, and this was even in, you know, 2008, which now we look back with, you know, rose-colored glasses because it seems so great. But what I also realized was that this hate was driven by deep misconceptions or totally made up BS about what the other side actually thought. And you can always point, you know, they always could find some idiot spouting something terrible and saying, well, that's just what the other side must think because it's all I'm exposed to. And I realized that there was a massive disconnect where both sides had a deep misunderstanding of reality about the other. And that was really enough for me to get the study started early, informally. And then in 2014, I teamed up with Matt Green, a good friend of mine, and we decided to take it on in earnest.
And how did you, well, we'll talk more about what you discovered in the book, but how did you, where did you start? How did you begin this this inquiry? Who did you talk to, and how did you come to your conclusions?
So my training at MIT to do political science was to be really data focused. And that training was invaluable for writing Wedge, because I, you know, we came in with this hypothesis that maybe what we see is not all that's going on. And we had to, you know, we had to make those hypotheses a little more concrete. But then we really got down to the data. There's, you know, the upshot of all of the political polling that's done, you know, for elections is that we can actually learn a lot about the electorate and what they really believe. And so the most important step for our study was understanding good survey methodology, because you can design a survey to sort of get people to answer things one way, and you can change the wording a little bit and you'll change the answers. So with this kind of good survey methodology underneath our belts, we looked into different ways of asking the same question about people's opinions on things as controversial as abortion, guns, gay marriage, all sorts of stuff about the economy and education. And we found that if you use loaded terminology, people take sides immediately and hate the other side. If you use more neutral terminology about what solutions people actually want and what they want the end state to look like, we found that they deeply agree. And it was this sort of large end study of these surveys that helped us really start to shed light on what was going on.
You know, at the Unrig the System conference in New Orleans in February, there were two presenters from the Harvard Business School who talked about the term, I'd never heard this term before, but they talked about the political industrial complex. And, you know, to their way of thinking that there was actually an entity, an informal entity in place that so benefits from the way things are, from these kind of designing polls to, as you were suggesting, to activate separation rather than shed light on the issue. So we seem to have a system that is heavily invested in things the way they are. So how do we address that?
Precisely. This is the sort of tragedy of the commons that, you know, let's say, for example, you're a politician. You are not going to benefit from people who are kind of on the fence and have these complex, nuanced set of opinions, or at least are aware of the complexity and nuance of their own opinions. You benefit from people who are ready to fight a war, because it means they're reliable and it means that they're going to take action for you, donate, vote, campaign, et cetera. And this, because this is entrenched in these incentives for the politicians themselves, for the media that wants you to watch, and for this kind of background political industrial complex that makes money on all the polling and et cetera, it's not going to change on its own. These incentives are stuck in place. What we ultimately need to do is change the incentives by, if we think about this economically, by changing the demand, by being different consumers of media, different consumers of dialogue, different consumers of politicians. And that, Steve, is where, when you speak about crisis leading to an evolution, leading to an uprising, we can talk more detail about what that looks like for the Wedge, but that's precisely what needs to happen. It needs to happen with each of us.
Right, exactly. And again, I think people are waking up. I'm traveling around the country right now. In every place I go, I see people who may have voted for one candidate or another. And at the same time, they're so deeply dissatisfied. We've been working with Joan Blades from Living Room Conversations in creating conversations between people on different sides. And they find out exactly what you were saying, that we really have more common areas of agreement when the heat is turned down and the light is turned up. So how do we begin to get people to change their demand about the kinds of media that they're – and where are those new media?
Great question. The first and most important step for any individual that wants to break out of this cycle is to understand that it's happening to you, how it's happening to you, and what that looks like. Because what happens is these forces that make you angry and scared, they appeal to your emotional brain, not your logical brain. So you typically don't have time to stop and think about it. What's required is a heightened level of awareness of what these kinds of things look like. So you notice them and you go, aha, I see it. I understand, I see what you're trying to do to me right now. And I'm not going to stand for it because I want to think for myself. So once that step has happened, then our appetite changes. Then we're actually going to go through the effort of making a change about how we consume our media and how we have different conversations. And if you want, I can talk about a few examples of the media I like, but I know that it's a big and evolving space, and I worry I wouldn't necessarily do it justice.
Well, you know what? We're going to be taking a break shortly, and when we come back, I'd like to open that up to talk about how some of these wedge issues have been unraveled, and transformed. I know you have a couple, at least one example in your book. We can talk about that. And I think you're absolutely right. Becoming aware of the problem is really the first step. This is Steve Behrman. We're talking with Eric Fogg about his book, Wedged. We'll be back after this break.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hello, Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. We're back with our guest, Eric Fogg. He's the co-author of Wedged, How You Became a Tool for the Partisan of the Partisan Political Establishment and How to Start Thinking for Yourself Again. We were talking about what the bright spots are beyond becoming aware. Once you become aware that you've been manipulated emotionally, and it's very hard to not be manipulated. I mean, we have a president. Resisting this president seems to be irresistible, and yet it puts people back on the same battlefield that perhaps caused the problem. What kinds of positive signs do you see in regards to media? And then let's talk about how some of these wedged issues have been dissolved and transformed.
Yeah, great. So on the media front, I think the best thing that I've seen crop up over the past 10 years is John Gable's AllSides.com. And the reason I think this is, well, what AllSides does is it, one, will show you different perspectives from the left, center, and right on, you know, different issues that are timely. And it also has a bias rating on different media outlets that's programmatically derived rather than just someone, you know, someone's opinion. And so what this means is that if we're actually hungry for understanding different perspectives so that we can think for ourselves, we've got a resource that points us in the directions that we can go. So the reason I like this so much is that, you know, it's anytime one wants to say like, this media here, like this is the bastion of truth and objectivity, it's really hard to defend that perspective because in the end, not only is opinion a matter of bias, but so is curation, like what is covered, what details are covered, et cetera. I think if you want to, you know, for those of us who want to really think for ourselves, we have to be able to understand something from multiple perspectives so that we can sniff out the BS and start seeing what's real.
You know, I really like the meme and the context of thinking for yourself because it's something that appeals to both the progressive left and the conservative and libertarian right. It kind of awakens people suggesting that, you know, perhaps we've been put in a trance that gets perpetuated by being fed constantly what we already know. And I consider John Gable a colleague and associate. We met about a month ago, and I certainly appreciate how he's what he's doing. The question is, how do we begin to wean people from the stimulation that comes from being adrenalized by these issues? You know, we get a charge out of that. There's something about that that gives us perhaps a dopamine hit, and it gets reinforced. How do we help people shift from that the stimulus of politics as usual, to coming toward thinking for themselves, reflecting and recognizing the different perspectives?
I love the way that you've described it, in particular because from a biological and psychological perspective, you've just described an addiction, right? It's something that's very destructive for you that you cannot quit because you get so much dopamine and serotonin out of it. And so how do we help people deal with addictions? Well, guess what? As we already discussed, the first step is admitting there's a problem. And then after that, I think it's sort of a two-step process. One is helping our patient to really deeply and emotionally visualize the impact, the negative impact on their life, their community, their country, whatever it is they really care about, really understand the negative impact that their behavior is having, right? And how they are contributing to it. Because unlike a normal addiction, where it's, say, alcohol or something, and it's your liver, one, you know, you can blame everyone else, and two, you can distance yourself from the problem. And so it takes a little bit more work to understand why this is so bad. And then, of course, the other side of it is to show a better way, a new way, right? You need to give someone something that replaces the old addiction and creates a sense of satisfaction and meaning in what they're doing to fill in what they're letting go of.
Well, first of all, I think you've really created a breakthrough here because you've, instead of 12-step, you've created a 2-step program, which should mathematically work 6 times faster. And I think you're right. I think that we do need to, first of all, maybe we need to form Citizens Anonymous, maybe, and do an intervention because this really is an intervention on the whole system. And as you said, it's an intervention on ourselves. We, more than most addictions, as you suggest, this is one that we tend to externalize and project on those guys out there. Those people out there are forcing me to take this position because they are so extreme. So I think that even having this conversation and people simply asking themselves, where have I been emotionally leveraged by something that I read? And, you know, if I rush to post to Facebook, make a Facebook post, and I hit send too quickly and I created an enemy unnecessarily. So I think that this is really very, very important to recognize that we have been made to become addicted to these kinds of stimuli, and we have allowed ourselves to. You know, we can't be passive about it. So let's look at perhaps some areas where there's been a breakthrough. Any issues that have been wedge issues where there's been a breakthrough?
Yes, I think there are a lot of little wins going on out there, and I think what's interesting is the one that I think is the biggest win over the past 10 years was one of the most controversial, and it is gay marriage. And I remember, you know, I was born in the 80s. I remember in the 90s when nobody was advocating for gay marriage except for the Libertarian Party, and everyone thought they were kooky. And then eventually the Democrats came around, and, you know, in 2010 or 2011, Barack Obama was the first president, after being against gay marriage, to become for it. And what is shocking about what happened with gay marriage is it's now a non-issue. After being a heated, contentious fight where people lost friends, et cetera. And it's also probably the civil rights issue that has been resolved fastest. From when it came to the front, you know, the stage of the United States to the time that it was settled and everyone decided to move on, has been the shortest time period of any issue. And this is a huge sign of hope for a lot of reasons. But what was the thing that made gay marriage different from, say, abortion, from gun control, from a lot of other issues? The big thing that happened was that the people who had the most at stake in this being, you know, LGBT people, they became humanized. They didn't make it, you know, if you think of pride parades and other advocacy for gay marriage, they didn't take an approach of, oh, if you're against gay marriage, you're a monster, you're terrible, get your religion out of my life, et cetera, et cetera. Some people did that, but the gay community did not. They humanized the gay community to people that didn't understand them yet, and it was through love and community that they brought enough people around that the issue was settled, as opposed to through war fighting.
Wow, that's really very interesting. And I think one of the things that happened, of course, is that as more gay people felt comfortable coming out of the closet into a community of acceptance, when they did, their parents and their loved ones who may have held opposing beliefs were put into that state of cognitive dissonance, which is really the only way that things change. You know, you're greatly uncomfortable with something until you recognize that this is a human issue. There are people who I love who are dealing with this. It's time for me to let go of my rigid point of view. There was a very poignant, and perhaps you saw it, poignant photograph, and this had to do with a man in the South. He looked like your typical, you know, older Southern gentleman, working class, rural, and he was holding a sign, and his sign had to do with the regret that he had for not accepting his gay daughter, who sadly had committed suicide, and he was essentially letting other people see his regret and hoping that they would not take the path that he took, and it was an extremely poignant photo.
Yes. And this issue lays out a path for other issues. you know, what, you know, if we actually want to win on an issue rather than, or resolve an issue rather than just keep fighting about it, which, remember, the system wants you to keep fighting. It doesn't want this stuff to get resolved, because when you're mad, you vote, you tune in, etc. So if you want to change it, what's the path you can take? Well, first, instead of war fighting, right, we humanize, we go to the other side, and we understand what do they really need. In the example of gay marriage, you know, there are still people who think, you know, there's still a lot of people who, for example, are Christian or some other religion, that, you know, their book or their spiritual leaders say, hey, look, we think this is wrong, right? Like, dogmatically. And what did they really need? Well, they needed a space for, in their private religion, in their church or their temple, they didn't have to, you know, nobody was forcing them to perform gay weddings. And that allowed them to have their space of their religion, and nobody had to come in and crush them. Where, you know, what the gay community needed was, and it was made clear that, oh, look, these people are, they are together, and what they need is, you know, the ability to go to each other's hospital beds when they're in trouble and make decisions for each other and have legal rights to buy houses together and such. And we realized that these aren't mutually contradictory. They can both exist.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that really was quite an amazing miracle. It was almost like the Berlin Wall coming down in a certain regard, that that wall was so strong, you know, and people were so strongly on one side of this thing or other, and then all of a sudden it dissolved. Very interesting. How can we
and now that it's not
how can
an
we
issue,
learn from
oh,
that?
Sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead. Say what you're.
I was going to say, and now that it's not an issue, many of the people that were fighting and upset about it in the 2000s, if they hear someone say, you know what, I don't, you know, I'm a Catholic or something, I don't think gay people should get, you know, religiously married, and there are some churches that disagree with me, like, people don't pick a fight about it anymore, because they go, oh, it's resolved, right? So the heat is off, the stakes seem lower, and there's space for other people to have their opinions as well.
Yes, exactly. I think that most people want respect. They do not want to be overwhelmed by force of somebody else's opinion. And when people are respected, they tend to be flexible. They tend to be understanding. They're not backed into a corner. And they shift from the amygdala part of the brain to the hippocampus. So how can other issues be unraveled and unwrapped like this? Like, for example, the abortion issue. That's still a biggie. That's the one that's being used right now by both sides, really.
Absolutely, yes. And for anyone thinking that it's one side, that, like, you're sort of on the defense from the offense, you know, regardless of what perspective you come from, remember that it energizes your side just as much. The political leadership on your side of the thing, even if it is saying we're under attack from these awful people, they win from it too. And so if we look to abortion, for example, one of the interesting things about abortion is that when you get down to the nuts and bolts, the vast majority of Americans are fine with abortions that occur between 20 and, or that have a limit to somewhere between 20 and 24 weeks. Most Americans are, in fact, very uncomfortable with, for example, the idea of abortions being allowed in the ninth month. And almost no Americans actually want abortion to be banned, you know, from conception. And almost nobody, you know, wants to stop abortions in the case of a mother at risk, et cetera. And so the thing is, there's actually a lot of space that Americans are, when you ask them about these options, they're willing to come together and say, you know what, for a, you know, legal solution, for a legislative solution, this is good enough. And I, of course, have my own feelings about it. But we can make this happen. And the reason we haven't made this happen is because the times you keep getting reminded about abortion as an issue, it's an existential, it's either a war on women or it's a war on babies' lives and the other side just wants to hurt people, remember that. Don't you dare compromise with them. But it's sitting right there for us to pluck if we want to take it.
Boy, what an amazing truth. That really is true, that the conversation until now has been completely controlled by those two philosophical memes that really, when you come down to practical things, you have to practically do something. And so this is why I say that one of the purposes of my show is to help us come together to find solutions, like what you're talking about, gathering around that middle space where, most of the time people support abortions and so on in these cases. And rather than defending these positions, which are intellectual positions that are emotionally held. So when we come back for the final segment, I want to talk about how this kind of massive education can take place on a broader scale, and where it is that people can go and they want to gather together and say, you know what, we want to solve this issue rather than merely keep fighting one position against the other. It takes a tremendous amount of energy and time and psychic energy, and what I believe is that in the division of us into two political tribes, we've essentially had a coup in this country of people who don't really care about the well-being of America's people, but would rather manipulate them into one position or another, so people don't unite around holding our governance accountable as an honesty. So thank you, Eric Fogg, for starting this conversation. We'll be back for our final segment to talk about how we've been wedged and how we can heal the wedgie.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Well, we're back with an enlightening conversation with Eric Fogg. He's the author of Wedge, How You Became a Tool of the Partisan Political Establishment and How to Start Thinking for Yourself Again. Well, you mentioned, Eric, the jokey term that I use, the upwising, people waking up and wising up, and I think that there is such a readiness. What I love about your book is that you lay it out very clearly how we actually came under this spell. You give the historical reasons. It's not a matter of blaming people. It's simply looking at the conditions and how they developed so that we are where we are. Now that we're here and now that people are so ready to wake up, what is the process for people awakening and how do we overgrow this condition?
Great question. I think there's obviously a personal component and there's also a structural component. There are things we can change about the system that make it easier for us to be our best. Just as an analogy, Steven Pinker's Better Angels of Our Nature talks about how the centralization of authority and rule of law makes us less violent. Like we are prone to be less violent because of structural changes that have occurred in government. So what are some of the structural changes that can help us here? One of them is to change how we vote. So for reasons that we can get into if you want, our voting structure benefits or leads to a two-party system. There are other countries with more than two parties. And if we took on voting systems like theirs, we would have more than two parties. And what would more than two parties do? Well, it would mean that if you want to win, you can't just say, let's say there are five parties. It's really hard to make a case for why those other four parties are all evil monsters in their own unique, terrible ways. It becomes much easier, and this has been shown to be the case that it works, to have a positive message about why we're the best party and the best option. And so you can extrapolate how that would dramatically change the way that both media and politicians talk about political issues in the United States, which would influence us as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good example. Of course, the system as it is so entrenched, we'll have to talk about how enough of us gather outside the system to impact that change. What other kinds of structural changes do you see that would help us overgrow this condition?
Yeah, so I think one of them is going to be getting artificial intelligence assistance on news. So we are all aware of the growth of fake news because in the past, in the United States in the 20th century, we had institutions that were trusted and their trust was valuable to them in the marketplace, these being like big newspapers and such, that provided us news so we could trust them. That has changed a lot with the internet. What's going to have to occur is getting some technological help to establish trustworthiness of different sources. And I think that this is, I feel optimistic about it in part because each generation gets more savvy about old technologies and old ways of digesting information than the one before. Typically, a new technology fools a new generation and frustrates them, and then a next generation takes on or carries it on gracefully. The other thing we could talk about, Steve, if you want, are some of the institutions that are rising to help us as well.
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful. That's a really good, because I think people go, where can I go? Where can I go? And by the way, I think you're right. I think that our institutions, here's an example, all of the mainstream media fell into line behind the Iraq War, and Phil Donahue was fired, the most popular commentator on NPR, Phil Donahue, was fired. And at that point, simply because he disagreed with the war, and at that point, yes. NPR, at least in my view, began to lose credibility. And so every time a mainstream news media doesn't cover a story that other people are able to see, that what they're doing is they're essentially covering up an official position, that is what has eroded trust. And that's why somebody like Donald Trump can come in with real fake news and say, well, look at, they've been lying to us all along. So obviously it's okay if I offer some untruths here. So I think people know that. I am interested in what are the emerging institutions that are going to help us out of this?
Yes, I love the point you made that, you know, as much as our political factionalization is very dangerous for us right now, conformity for the sake of conformity is no better, right? If there was only one perspective and one message and we're forced to agree on it, that would be even worse. So what do we do to create a space where we disagree productively, right, and learn from each other? I think that the institutions that I'm aware of that are doing this best are all found at a place called the Bridge Alliance. And the Bridge Alliance mm-hmm. is a group of, oh my gosh, it's growing every day, I think 80 plus or large organizations, substantial organizations that are operating probably in your community that are all sorts of different ways for you to get involved, from as simple as, hey, I want to actually have a conversation with a facilitated conversation with someone who disagrees with me so I can learn more, or, I want to get involved in getting money out of politics or bringing, changing how we vote to bring more third parties in, or I'm looking for more information about the common ground that we have or the agreement we have, or I'm looking for ways to test different media for dependability. All of these things exist in the Bridge Alliance. They are all growing, not only in number, but each of them is getting stronger over time. And I think that this is one great place for us to access the institutions and groups of people that are trying to bring about the positive change that the country needs.
I appreciate that. And of course, I've interviewed Joan Blades from Living Room Conversations. John Gable's on my agenda for the near future. And the thing is that this may be the first time that my listeners are hearing about this Bridge Alliance. How do people access this group of organizations?
So the website is bridgealliance.us. Bridge being BRIDGE, and it's really a delightful buffet / smorgasbord for you once you click our members. I think if you have any interest in being part of the solution, or even just improving, even if just self-improvement, and want to just stop being part of the problem, you're going to find one of these great organizations that's going to be able to help you. And as you mentioned, both Joan and John are their organizations, Living Room Conversations and All Sides, are part of the Bridge Alliance.
Mm-hmm. I love your phrase, disagree productively, because I think that there's a dynamo that happens when, we've also interviewed Tom Attlee, who wrote The Tao of Democracy. And
yes.
For many, many years, there have been these ways for people to come together, to express themselves, to be heard, and then as the nuances of these different points of view are expressed, people begin to think differently about the issues, and they begin to get energized by coming up with solutions together rather than being manipulated from the outside. Tell us more about other ways that people can begin to shift the way that we communicate about politics.
Great question. This is there's two steps to changing how we talk about politics as individuals. The first is changing our mindset, and the second is changing our techniques. So we've talked a lot about the mindset already without using the word. It's changing our intent in these conversations from making someone else wrong or feel wrong to learning enough that we can actually reach, that we can start having a true productive conversation. And that mindset shift occurs when we realize that we have been part of the problem because we've been manipulated into being these tools. That's when the mindset changes and you start to go, I don't want to be part of the problem anymore. After that, there is a skill set that emerges. In particular, in such a, you know, such a touchy environment where you bring up the wrong thing and someone freaks out, you need to become talented at what is essentially sales. So you can imagine yourself as a salesperson having a conversation with someone else that you genuinely disagree with. So you're going to want them to consider your point of view. But the people who are actually, I think, best at teaching us how to get someone to consider a point of view that they've never considered before is the people who have, you know, for millennia, had to change people's minds in order to eat. And those are salespeople. So I actually, on my own website, Reconsider Media, point people to great books about being a salesperson in order to help them learn some new techniques.
You know, it's interesting. The greatest of salespeople never really close a sale. They somehow get people to close themselves, if you know what I'm talking about.
Precisely.
You know, you kind of lead. And so it's not about banging somebody over the head with your point of view. It's perhaps eliciting questions, just as a salesperson might call for objections at the right time. You know, well, you know, what's in the way of you're making this decision? And I think that the really undervalued quality of curiosity is really important, and being able to listen to the other person for the genuine concerns they have underneath. And as you would say, a good salesperson must know how to listen.
Absolutely. And I think one of the best ways to get to that point of listening is to, we just need to have a few examples where the thing that you were so certain of turns out to be either one, totally wrong, or two, totally unclear. And once you've had that experience a few times, you're much more prone to listen. And if you want a quick dose of that, I recommend actually reading a little bit of Plato's Republic, where what starts to happen is that everything we think about how a government should be run, everything we assume, gets upended using the Socratic method. And then you walk out going, huh, I wonder where we go from here.
You know, I think that what I've been hearing a lot lately from a number of people who are dealing with the vexing problems of the world is being in the space of not knowing. And, you know, it's very humbling because, again, our egos want us to look good. They want us to be smart. They want us to know. You're an expert. You're supposed to know. And so the space of not knowing, it's not wishy-washy. It's simply a way of being able to encompass new information so that there are new pathways that are created. So clearly, this is a way of somehow reducing the heat on something by giving yourself the opportunity to listen to somebody and giving them and you the space to be wrong, quote unquote, without being judged. I made a mistake. I didn't know that. My friend Correct. Caroline Casey, her favorite question is, did you know? Did you know? It's kind of like a way of conveying information, not to berate people for not knowing it, but a kind of a way of evoking curiosity. Like, I just discovered something. Did you know?
Yeah.
And so on. And much better ways of communicating. So we got a couple of minutes left. How do people find your book, first of all, and how do they find you online, Eric?
Yeah, sure. So they can to find me online, and sort of everything else comes out of there if you'd like. It's reconsidermedia.com, R-E-C-O-N-S-I-D-E-R, reconsider. Our blog, our podcast are there. You can get linked to Wedged. Wedged is available on Amazon, paperback or e-reader. And so if you search for just wedged under books will be the first one, which is great.
That's very good. And anything else that you want to share to people who are going, okay, I'm ready to make a change. What is it that's going to have the most impact in the short run, so that people feel encouraged that things are moving in the right direction, which they are. You mentioned the Bridge Alliance, and I totally agree. I've been working with those folks for years, but nobody knows about them yet.
Yes. Two things, one on the personal front and one on the institutions front. On the personal front, the thing that's going to sort of shake you out of your doldrums the most is if you commit to finding someone that you already know and love and trust who deeply disagrees with you and walk in saying, you know what, we are the same tribe. We are one tribe, and everything you say in that political conversation with them, every time you use a pronoun, it is we, not you, not I, not us, not them, we. And if you do that, you will be amazed at what happens. And then on the institutional side,
wow,
find something you love, get involved. It's going to be great.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Eric Fogg, the author of Wedged. And I think we have some directions to unwedge the wedgie. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki, thank you for listening.